Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we discuss the life and work of Thomas Wolfe, one of the country's leading novelists of the early 20th century. A contemporary of Hemingway, Fitzgerald, and Faulkner, Wolfe is best known for his first novel, Look Homeward, Angel. He would publish four books during his lifetime and is an important figure in American literature for his autobiographical fiction and other ways he experimented with form. Wolfe died at the age of 37, leaving behind a massive manuscript that would lead to more publications following his death. He is remembered as a key figure in the Southern Renaissance and influenced the likes of Jack Kerouac, Ray Bradbury, Philip Roth, and countless others. For this episode, we are joined by members of the Thomas Wolfe Society, Joseph Bentz, American literature professor and articles editor of the Thomas Wolfe Review, Mark Canada, scholar, writer, and chancellor of Indiana University Kokomo, and Paula Eckert, professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Joe, Mark, and Paula are interviewed by Nate King, digital content associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place July 26th, 2024, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Mark, Paula, and Joe, for joining me today on this episode of Nation of Writers. I'm quite excited to talk to you about Thomas Wolfe and hear your expertise and learn from you, as you are all members of the Thomas Wolfe Society. So we're excited to hear a little bit about that as well. Before we get into that, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and your relationship to Thomas Wolfe and his work? Mark, we'll start with you.
Sure, Nate. Delighted to be here. Thanks for the invitation. I'm a professor of American literature and have been for a long time. I work as a chancellor right now, so I've gone into a university administration, but have not lost my love of literature and of Thomas Wolfe. Been a member of the society for some two decades now and have written a number of things about Thomas Wolfe and worked on something called Thomas Wolfe Remembered, which is a collection of reminiscences about him. So I feel that I know the real Thomas Wolfe on some level.
That's great. I love that. And Paula, how about yourself?
I'm Paula Eckert, and I am a professor of English at UNC Charlotte in Charlotte, North Carolina. I teach Southern and American literature, and my connection to Wolfe is that as part of my research and teaching in Southern literature, he's a major figure in that arena. I've written and published on Wolfe. I'm a past president of the Thomas Wolfe Society and currently the editor of the Thomas Wolfe Review.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Joe, how about yourself?
I'm a professor of American literature at Azusa Pacific University in Southern California, and I've been reading and studying Wolfe since the 1980s when I wrote my PhD dissertation on Wolfe, and since then I've done a lot of writing and speaking on Wolfe, and this summer I've worked on two Wolfe projects, and so Wolfe is a big part of my life. I also help Paula with the Thomas Wolfe Review. I'm the articles editor, so I send out article submissions to consulting editors.
Wonderful. Thank you. And now's a great time. Tell us more about the Thomas Wolfe Society and in your roles with that. There's the Thomas Wolfe Review, right?
The Review is a wonderful compendium of articles, scholarly articles, feature articles, very riveting notes about Thomas Wolfe. You would be amazed how much material is continued to be generated on Wolfe. And the Thomas Wolfe Society itself is an exceptional organization. It's an author society that's, gosh, I can't remember when it was founded. Mark, you might know, but it's a very eclectic group of scholars, writers, readers, people from all backgrounds all over the world. It's truly an international group.
Hundreds of members, and it's been around for more than 40 years now. We meet every year in various places, often someplace that's associated with Thomas Wolfe, but not always. So every other year, roughly, we meet somewhere in North Carolina at Asheville, where he grew up, for example, or possibly at Chapel Hill, where he went to undergraduate school. But we've also met in a variety of other places, even Idaho, where he was passing through on his trip out west. And this coming year in 2025, we are looking forward to meeting in Chicago, hoping to attract some new interest in Thomas Wolfe. Wolfe did not spend a lot of time in Chicago. He passed through there on his way west on his final journey when he didn't realize it was his final journey. We'll probably get to that later, but he was a relatively young man, but traveling out west, he wanted to see the West. He loved America, loved to see all of the cities and the landscapes. So he passed through Chicago, wasn't there for a long time, but we're more interested in simply trying to attract some new audiences to Thomas Wolfe. So we'll be in Chicago 2025.
Oh, yeah, we're excited for that too. So, yeah, so now is maybe a good time to give us a little bit of biographical and historical context for Wolfe. So, he's born in 1900 in Asheville, North Carolina. And then, where does he go from there?
Well, he grew up in Asheville and writes about that in Look Homeward, Angel. So, you find out a lot about his work is very autobiographical. So, you find out about that upbringing. Then he went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill for his undergrad work. After that, went to Harvard University and studied playwriting with George Pierce Baker, who also taught Eugene O'Neill. Then Wolfe loved to travel. He went to England, went to Europe, went to Germany. So throughout the 1920s and his 20s, he was traveling, wanted to become a playwright and wrote plays, but as he himself said, his rather expansive way of writing didn't fit very well into plays. So that didn't work out too well. Decided instead to write novels, worked on his first novel, which was originally called O Lost, and later changed to Look Homeward, Angel. He moved to New York City, and that's where he met Maxwell Perkins, also the editor of Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, among others. And Perkins accepted Look Homeward, Angel for publication, and that really launched Wolfe's career as an author. Throughout the 30s, he continued to write novels and short stories, and died very young. He was only 37 years old, died in 1938. So we really regret that in the Thomas Wolfe world, because who knows what he might have done if he had lived longer. But that's a quick overview of his life.
Might be worth mentioning too, that in his own time period, he was a giant. Now, physically, he was a giant too. He was 6'6". But in terms of his literary stature, he was a giant too. And it's unfortunate for those of us who love Wolfe to realize that now he doesn't command exactly the same level of attention as a Hemingway or a Faulkner. And we can talk about that later, maybe later on, why he doesn't. But in his own time, Look Homeward, Angel was a very successful novel. He was a very successful novelist, was widely regarded. Faulkner spoke highly of him. And again, he worked with, as Joe said, with Maxwell Perkins, who was the greatest editor in the history of American literature. The only other thing I would add to that is that for folks listening to this, if they'd like to learn more about that relationship between Perkins and Wolfe, I highly recommend the film Genius, which all of us Wolfe scholars know, but was not really well known in the theaters. It sounds a little bit like a niche movie, and I suppose it is, a movie about an editor and a writer. How could that possibly be interesting? But it is, and it actually attracted some major Hollywood stars. So Colin Firth and Nicole Kidman and Jude Law all performed in this film. So those are some heavy hitters in a movie about an editor and his writer. I think they all do a nice job too. So it's a very interesting movie, and I would recommend it to anybody, even if they're not so crazy about writers and editors. It's actually a well-done film, I thought.
And it's also a love letter to writing and editing.
Yes.
As well as to the people involved. No, it's quite moving.
Yeah, that's definitely on my list now. You said it's a niche, but that is our very specific niche. So it's right up our alley.
Well, Hemingway and Fitzgerald make appearances in that movie as well.
Oh, right. Yeah. So it's actually based on a book by Scott Berg, who is a major biographer. The book is actually about Perkins, and there's lots of material in the book about Perkins' relationship with Hemingway and with Fitzgerald and with Wolfe. But when they made the movie, and I don't know a lot of the backstage behind making the movie, but they made it focus on Wolfe and Perkins. And Joe's right, of course, there are little appearances of Hemingway and Fitzgerald too, but it's really mainly about Perkins and Wolfe.
And the timing of the contemporaries of Wolfe, like you've mentioned, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, Hemingway, that sort of time in American history and literature. is fascinating to me because, unfortunately, I think, names like Hemingway, like those three names are perhaps more readily known and recognized than Wolfe, but yet he was, like you said, a literary giant. What about his work, or perhaps the reception of it after his death, has do you think has led to the sort of lesser stature nowadays? Or it's coming back more now, but why isn't Wolfe's name up there with Hemingway and Faulkner as much as perhaps it should be? What do you think that is?
Well, like Joe and Paula, I have taught Wolfe, and I will say, I think partly it's simply a practical matter. His novels are just so long. So, as somebody who's taught the American novel, I can say it's easy to work in The Great Gatsby and The Sun Also Rises or Farewell to Arms, even one of Faulkner's novels. And you almost can't do the American novel without doing The Sound and the Fury. But Wolfe's novels are usually two, three, four times as long as those. So it's partly, I think it's a practical matter, but there are probably other considerations too. I'd be interested in what Joe and Paula think about that one.
I think part of the reason that Wolfe fell from view, from grace, so to speak, was the damage that was done to his reputation by critics such as Harold Bloom and Bernard DeVoto, who saw, in a very scathing article, DeVoto wrote about, the Perkins-Wolfe relationship and thought Perkins should get more credit for Wolfe's genius. And I think the title of the article was Genius Is Not Enough. Well, Wolfe waltzed into Perkins' office with manuscripts that were in boxes. If I submitted something like that to an editor, they would laugh me out of the room. But Perkins worked with Wolfe to help get the best from Wolfe, but he was faulted for that. I think in the 1980s that turned around, and scholars and critics began seeing the value in the Wolfe and value in Wolfe's fiction and writing.
I think Wolfe's novels, they're long, as Mark said, they're also very loosely plotted. And they're very exuberant. And I think that literary tastes after Wolfe ran more toward the more controlled, carefully plotted works of Fitzgerald or Hemingway, and also the greater experimentation of narrative techniques of Faulkner. So the big immersive novels that Wolfe was writing were just out of literary favor, out of literary style, in a sense. And so it's a reading a Wolfe novel is a different experience. Even reading a Wolfe short story, he still does a lot of that type of thing in the short story. So I think that it is harder, even when I teach American novel, as Mark was saying, I love Wolfe, but it's hard to put him into a semester-long course, unless one time I had the students read half of Look Homeward, Angel, hoping that they would on their own read the second half. But it's hard, to put a 750-page novel if you're trying to cover 8 or 9 or 10 novels.
I'm remembering that talk you gave about Wolfe and form, even in short fiction. Your comments just reminded me of that. Joe gave a talk at a Thomas Wolfe Society conference meeting talking about Wolfe's own understanding, appreciation, or lack of appreciation of standard conventional forms. And so, if we're, as American literature teachers or any kind of English professor, if you're teaching the novel, the short story, you're going to talk about certain formal elements. That's partly what we do. It's like teaching poetry and iambic pentameter and trochaic trimeter. I mean, that's partly what. But when you talk about Wolfe, there's no, Joe, help me get this right. It's almost like there's no slot to put him in. And I don't think he didn't care about, but we as professors feel compelled to talk about form, and Wolfe didn't care about it.
I was just going to say, I think the secret to teaching Wolfe is, at least in today's environment, is to be selective and to introduce Wolfe in smaller doses. His novella, The Lost Boy, is perfect for that. And it's very successful in the classroom. And his short stories also have been, but again, you have to be selective. And but his prose is so luminous and so you know, when you take time, it is accessible, but it's the daunting nature of those big novels that I think students struggle with. I did teach the whole of Look Homeward, Angel in one of my classes. It might have been a graduate class, and even my graduate students struggled to get to the end. But I think those who persisted were amply rewarded.
I agree with Paula about The Lost Boy. I've taught it over the past 30 years, and it's just really goes over well with students. So if anybody's looking for what to start with teaching of Wolf, I would start with The Lost Boy. It's a story about grief, about memory. It really shows Wolf's experimentation and narrative structure. He does some very interesting things narratively in how he tells that story. So there's so much to talk about with that story.
I agree. And that you all have mentioned his experimentation with form and narrative, and which was a thing that captivated me as well in researching Wolf. So I wonder if you can expand on that, because I also, you know, came across that he's, you know, in the autobiographical fiction, he was kind of maybe not the first to do it, but what really, like, one of the first to master it, which is so prevalent. I see today some of my favorite books I like to read are autobiographical fiction. And so, yeah, I'm just curious if you could all speak to his, how he played around with the conventions and norms of literature at his time, and how he advanced that forward.
Well, the autobiographical nature of the work was one of the things he was criticized for, but it's also one of the things that I think is the most appealing about him. When you read Wolf, at least this was my experience when I first encountered him, I felt like this is the way it really is. He's capturing exactly what it feels like to be young, to be yearning, to be struggling, to be agonized. And he does that through his own life. There's such an authenticity to it that it is really appealing. Now, some of the critics, I think, just didn't get that. They found it too self-indulgent or overdone or something like that. But I think a lot of people who are attracted to Wolf's writing feel that sense of immersion into a world. One of the things I love about reading a Wolf novel is you're not just reading a nicely plotted story that does the conventional things with plot of the, you know, the rising action and the climax and all this sort of thing. What you're really doing is you're immersing yourself into his world. And that's why, even though we've talked about the length of the novels being a problem, it's also one of the joys of the novel, if you love Wolf, because you can enter into this world and stay there for a long time. And you really feel not just that you're reading a novel, but that you are experiencing the life of this protagonist. So that's one of the things that I love about Wolf.
And it's also being swept along with the prose. The language is so luxurious, and you see words put together, sentences put together, images put together in ways that, you know, just don't happen in, you know, much of fiction, certainly not today. I tend to gravitate towards the prose of Faulkner and Wolf more than the more concise, brief sentences and paragraphs and pages. I love language, and I love what Wolf does with it. And so if you're a reader and love words and love language, you know, Wolf is, you know, the one.
I agree wholeheartedly. It's funny to hear you say that, Paula, because I'm a sucker for words too. And I think about some of my favorite writers, and they are the ones who could craft a sentence like nobody else. And we can all disagree about this, but Wolf is in the top five. Melville is up there for me. I'm a big fan of Stephen Crane, and I'm not sure anybody could write a sentence like Mark Twain could. So you put those people up there. Now, some people don't go for that. You know, okay, well, that Wolf may not be your guy, but Paul and Joe both know we've interacted with a lot of Wolf fans over the year. Many members of the Thomas Wolfe Society are not scholars like us. They're people who simply fell in love with his prose, as Paula said, as young men or women, and were swept away, as you said, Paula, by the prose. In fact, his father loved Shakespeare, and you learn about this when you read Look Homeward, Angel. His father would walk around the house reciting Shakespeare, probably from memory. Well, you can't really escape that if you're a writer and a lover of words. And so Wolfe was hearing that. In fact, one of his close friends, his agent, Elizabeth Nowell, said that he wrote in iambic pentameter. Now, she's overemphasizing that. Not of all of his prose is written that way. But I think there is a certain kind of rhythmic power to his language. In fact, one of his editors said that he would actually get a little carried away with the rhythm of his sentences, and it might have taken away from the content. I don't know that that happened very often, but I could see that happening with Wolfe because he loved language as much as we love language.
Yeah, the mention of Shakespeare makes me think of a couple of things. First, his childhood and upbringing, which, I mean, maybe now is the time when we should spend some time on Look Homeward, Angel, because, you know, his first book, and I think the most widely recognized of his works, I'd say as well. Yeah, so maybe we'll spend a little time on the childhood and then how that is presented in Look Homeward, Angel. And I was surprised to hear that it was not necessarily received well in Asheville when it first came out. So I'd love to hear a little bit about the story of Look Homeward, Angel, starting with his upbringing with his parents. His dad, like you said, loved Shakespeare. His mother ran a boarding house, so a lot of characters coming in and out. I just love to hear more about that part of his life as well.
Wolfe had an amazing memory and could remember word for word conversations that had happened years ago. And that you really see that in Look Homeward, Angel. And he also, so he was capturing Asheville in Look Homeward, Angel. Now, he fictionalizes it, so we shouldn't overemphasize the autobiographical nature. There was one point where Wolfe said that someone had remembered, you know, a scene in the novel, and they had been there, and they remembered that exact conversation. Well, it was something Wolfe had made up. So his writing is so convincing that there were people who would think it really happened, even in places where it didn't.
Wow.
But he did not hold back in sharing the good and the bad of the people, of the citizens of Asheville. And, you know, when I read it today, it doesn't seem like a scandalous book or even that harsh of a book toward the people of Asheville. To me, it's ultimately a very loving portrait of the city, but they certainly didn't take it that way, many of them at the time. And Wolfe got nasty letters, and there's a letter, you know, with all sorts of misspellings in it where they threatened to drag his overgrown carcass across the town square if he ever comes back to Asheville and this sort of thing. But I think that just shows how effective he was in capturing what that place and what that upbringing was really like.
I don't know if this is true or not, but I heard that after he gained great fame for the novel, then people were upset if they weren't included in the novel.
I've heard that too, Paula. And he did stay away from Asheville. Help me out, Joe and Paula, for several years.
7 years.
Yeah.
7 years. Did not go back to his home. His family was still there.
Yeah.
Now, when he did go back, as Paula said, he was welcomed as a hero because by that time, he was very successful. So he was the local boy made good. But the immediate reaction was not positive at all.
I can tell you a little bit about the draw for me with Look Homeward, Angel. That was the Wolfe book I read, and I didn't read it until I was an adult. I was, you know, a young wife and mother. I had been a registered nurse and wasn't even in English at that time. And of course, I was pulled in, you know, by the story, by the prose. But what struck me because of my medical background was how much he talked about illness, death, the body, and probably the greatest death scene. Actually, it's not just a scene, it's a whole chapter of 30 plus pages of the death of his brother Ben from influenza pandemic that hit in 1918 to 1920. And it, you know, it was so moving. And, you know, as a nurse, I was fascinated by his treatment of illness and death, of doctors, of nurses, of healthcare. And that, you know, got me hooked and, you know, stayed with me over the years.
Yeah, I love that very unique perspective on those hard moments of death of loved ones is, yeah, difficult to experience, let alone write about.
And probably my favorite passage, I know we haven't gotten to passages or quotes yet, but is the one where the doctor is telling the family, telling the sister about poor Ben and how he's not going to survive, you know, this flu, this terrible flu. And the doctor says, in effect, you know, he's dying, you know, and he says, we're just a flash of fire, a heart, a brain, a spirit, you know, which speaks to the fragility of life, you know, and how temporal, you know, and impermanent we all are. But it's a wonderful scene. But the whole chapter is just stunning in its treatment of Ben's illness and death.
You know, it reminds me of something Joe said a minute ago, and I love the way you put this, Joe, that we are immersed in Wolf's world. And of course, we're also immersed in the world itself. It's not just about Wolf. If it were, we wouldn't care so much. But many of us have had some of the same experiences. And I'm thinking about some of the things that have been said about Wolf's writing. And one of them from Elizabeth Nowell, again, his agent, she said the strongest impulse in Wolf's life was his compulsion to pour out the history of his experience in talk, in letters, diaries, and most of all, in creative fiction. And I think that gives us a sense of why his writing is so powerful. As Joe said, he lived this and he was a highly sensitive human being in every possible way, in terms of the exuberance he felt when he was happy, the grief, the anger. He just felt more than I think a lot of us humans feel, but we feel some of the same things. And then he would put that in his writing. And then, as Joe said, we are immersed in that. But also, as Paula said, he wrote it in such a way that we're swept away by the prose. So it's really magnificent to relive these moments through Wolf's novels.
He captures so much about small town life in America. He captures details that you don't get in other writers. Just what is it like to be alive in that particular time and place? What do people eat? How do they dress? How do they interact with one another? What's it like to go to school there? What's it like to fall in love with someone? What's it like to be in that boarding house that his mother ran that he hated so much? What's it like to be rejected? What's it like? You know, all these specific things he brings you into, and that's what gives it such a sense of reality.
And also to be a member of a large family, a large and tempestuous family. I mean, when I first read it, I thought, oh my gosh, that's my dad's family of 10 children. How many siblings did Wolf have? I don't think there were 10, but it was so much like my dad's Southern family. And I, you know, that was another strong point of connection, just his depiction of family dynamics and dysfunction and humor and crises and all that you can imagine.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the humor in that too, because the family members they're dysfunctional, but they're also funny. And Wolf is a very funny writer. He really, even, you know, Paula was talking about the death of Ben, which I think is one of the highlights, you know, just one of the amazing aspects of the novel. But he also covers after Ben's death, the selection of the coffin. Well, it ends up being a very funny scene because this undertaker is trying to sell this coffin and trying to get them to buy the more expensive one. And the way Wolf handles that, it is funny. So you have this, he goes from the depths of grief and sadness to a funny scene. And then not too long after that, Eugene Gant, who's the main character, encounters Ben's ghost in the town square. And so as a reader, you're thinking, what is this about? This is very surprising. And so Wolf can change his tone and change what you're actually experiencing. It's not just the same thing all the time, but I think that certainly his sense of humor is another thing that keeps you wanting to keep reading. He has a lot of satire and sarcasm at times, but you know, you feel like he loves these family members, but also they drive him crazy. And I think a lot of people can relate to that.
Right.
They're so quirky. There's a lot of quirky people.
Right.
Yeah. I love the way you just described that, Joe, of like going between emotions, really, in a way of, you know, and what is life, if not that, of working your way through each one as they come. So I want to switch gears a little bit. As the American Writers Museum, we have to ask the process question, the writing process question. So I'm curious if any of you in your studies have learned about Wolf's writing process. I heard some interesting things on the internet, but I don't know if they're true, so I don't want to bring them up. But you know, Mark, maybe you have some insights into his, you know, how he wrote. From what I understand, almost everything longhand, right?
Yes, he never learned to type. So he wrote longhand, and then he had some typists who would type it up for him. Some of my favorite material from the Thomas Wolfe Remembered book comes from his typists. That's the wonderful thing about a writer like Thomas Wolfe, is that there were so many people who knew him and were fortunate enough to have all the reminiscences that we don't have to depend simply on what his mother said about him or what Perkins said about him or what his friends said about him. There were all these other people, including his students when he taught at New York University, and his typist. I think the book has three of his typists talking about, and which is, I mean, I'm an expert really more in Edgar Allan Poe than I am Thomas Wolfe. And I focus on the 19th century. You usually don't get that in the 19th century. You don't get those insights into how the writers actually put pen to paper. But you get that in Wolfe, and more so than any other writer I know of, because we have the typists, we have the editors talking about him. So one of his editors, Edward Aswell, who was second editor after he left Perkins and Scribner's in 1936, Aswell said he could not put anything that had happened to him out of his consciousness until he had rehearsed it in memory 1,000 times, going back over it again and again in every detail until he had got at the core of it and had extracted the last shred of meaning out of it on every level. And I think that's really important to realize about Wolfe's writing style. It was so much about, back to what Joe said about being immersed in it, he lived and felt so strongly. And then he did a lot of his early drafts, so to speak, in his mind. And we know that from what his editors and his typists said about him. So when it came time to actually put it on paper, and we have accounts of this, and again, this is in the book, his typists would say that he would start with some small talk and conversation, and he'd walk around and strut around and maybe recite a little Shakespeare. But when it came time for him to write, when he was ready to sit down and put pencil to paper, one of his typists said that the yellow pages flew like they were blown from a fan. He would write so fast, and he wrote, and one of his editors, I think it was one of his editors, said that his hand couldn't keep up with his mind. And so, and you know this, if you've ever seen his writing, I transcribed some of his writing. It's the hardest writing I've ever had to transcribe. He would make the first letter and the last letter, and in between, it was anybody's guess. Sometimes he couldn't even read his own writing. This is what one of the typists said. So you really get this insight of somebody who had done all the early draft work and thinking through those experiences, and probably on some level the language. But when it came time to write, it was all there for him. And he really didn't do a lot of revising early in his career. Now, as well, his editor said later on, he did more revising than most people realize. But when we think of Wolfe, we scholars think of Wolfe, simply when I think of Wolfe, I think of somebody who had done all this rehearsing in his mind, all this lived experience, and then when it came time to write, he could write like a machine.
And it was so prolific, like thousands of words a day. I'm lucky on a good day if I have a few hundred words.
Yeah.
But Wolfe, it was thousands and thousands. Wow. There's also a picture of him writing using the top of a refrigerator as a desk, which is just wonderful. He was, I guess, refrigerators are short, and he was very tall, so it worked out.
It reminds me of another photo we have of him with his crate. I thought that's where you were going with it, Paula. So he wrote so much, he kept it all in a crate. Now he'd also keep shoes and pots and pans and that kind of stuff. It was crazy. He was not a very neat person. But there's a famous picture of him with his foot up on this crate, about 4 feet long, 2, 3 feet high, filled with manuscript. So when he died, he had been working on a novel or something. I mean, his editors, his typer said he would just write whatever came to mind that day. No exaggeration. He wasn't writing, it's like Joe said, he wasn't really writing a novel in the sense of here's my exposition, here's the rising action. He literally, and we have several accounts to tell us this, he would just write whatever had moved him. He'd been thinking about the night before. He walked in and he suddenly remembered this memory of something from his early life. And it was time for him to spout all of that out, just like a torrent coming from his hand. So he would record all of this. But later on, he goes out west. He dies prematurely. We can come back to that. But after he dies, Edward Aswell, his second editor, has this stack of manuscript. Aswell said it was up to his chest from the floor, 5 feet of manuscript. And Aswell has to figure out what to do with this. Wolf, I guess, thought it was all going to go in one book, but you can't make a book out of that. So poor Aswell had to figure out. So we wound up coming out with three different books, but he also was going through multiple versions of the same scene. I mean, I just cannot, I'm not an editor, I'm a writer, but I cannot imagine trying to make any kind of sense out of that. It would be the hardest job any editor's ever done, I think.
That's fantastic. I do want to touch on that trip out west, and then his as you just mentioned, Mark, his untimely, very, very young death. Because it's we mentioned earlier, it's like, what if that didn't happen? There's so much more there, as we know. So yeah, could you tell our listeners a little bit about that trip that he took, and then what happened on it?
I'll say a few words about the trip itself because I've transcribed the notes from that trip, so I've immersed myself
Ooh.
in that. But Paul is much more equipped to talk about his death because she has a medical background and I certainly don't. So the reason why he went out there, he had some relatives out there in the far and the Pacific Northwest, wanted to see some relatives, but also just loved America and loved trains. So the opportunity to take a train across America, which he literally did, and that's when he passed through Chicago, as well as Indianapolis, as well as West Lafayette here in Indiana. But he goes out there and he sees all this spectacular scenery. It would be nice if he had written down more. We have some of his notebooks, and he didn't really write a lot. And some of it was really not designed to be published. It was just kind of scribblings, literally scribblings, almost impossible to read. But as he goes out there, he's out there to kind of experience the West. When he gets out there, he's at a party, bumps into some guy who's going to be traveling the national parks, I think 12 national parks. And Wolf says, "Hey, I'll go along." So, on a whim, he joins this guy and another guy, and they travel around all these parks. And so, we do have records of Wolf wrote about that as well. But then, unexpectedly, he meets his death, and I'll let Paula pick it up from there.
After they finished their tour of the national parks, I think it was around July 4th, and he was going to take a trip to Van take the ferry to Vancouver from Seattle. I believe that's right. And on that trip, the weather was bad. He wasn't feeling great. He shared a whiskey bottle with another passenger. And by the time they docked, he was very sick and spent, I think, a few days in the hotel room, very, very sick, and finally made it back to Seattle. And the thought is that a latent case of tuberculosis had, resurged because of whatever flu or virus that he had contracted during this trip. And he continued to get worse. He was talking out of his head. He had, I think, terrible, terrible headaches. And brain swelling, I think, was developing. The doctors in Washington said, "You need to see the best brain specialist," and that's Dr. Walter Dandy in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins. So Wolf was put on a train with a nurse. He traveled across the country, desperately ill, all the way to Johns Hopkins. And once he was there, Dr. Dandy, who was the best neurologist, neurosurgeon in the country, operated, thinking, they could, find something and treat it. And what it was is when they did go in, they found that he had tuberculosis of the brain, which is not very treatable at all, especially not then. It was inoperable. And, you know, Wolf died just a few days later. And I think at the end, he was, you know, pretty incoherent. I think at one point he called for whiskey, but it was just, you know, nothing could be done. And he died at the age of 38. He had a lifetime fear of tuberculosis. That was such a common disease during his era. Asheville was a noted place for the treatment of tuberculosis. I think some of the boarders at his mother's boarding house, even though she advertised no sick people for her boarding house, they surely stayed there, and he would have been exposed as a young person to tuberculosis. And then it went latent until this infection brought it out, you know, in his late 30s. So it was a terrible and tragic death. And, you know, we're all the sorrier for it. You know, I'd like to think, what would there have been if Wolf had lived to 60, 70, 80? You know, how much more would we have to read and study? But just in those few short years of his writing, we got so much.
You know, Paul, I'm embarrassed that I've never thought about this before, but what you just said, if he had lived till 80, he would have been alive in 1980. Imagine everything he could have written about in the 60s and the 70s. We just think of him as this person from the Depression era and the 20s. That's all he had a chance to write about. But I'm embarrassed I never thought about that. If he had lived on, all of the American history he could have written about.
And the American culture and the cultural changes. Oh my gosh. You know, I wish, you know, we could have him back and have him live a long life, and we'd have so much more.
You know, at one point, the Thomas Wolfe Review did a series on Wolfe. I think it was Wolfe at 60, what he would have been like. And they had various scholars speculate on what would have happened to him if he had lived to age 60. It's very interesting to see what people thought he might have done.
That is one of my questions as well that I always like to ask in these episodes is, you know, today. So that's, you know, at another 40 years on, of course, he would not have survived that long. But, you know, if he were alive today, how do you think he'd be engaging with our current world? And, you know, the mention of, you know, he survived a pandemic as well, as we all have also. So I'm curious, you know, the parallels I'm curious about, and just, yeah, how do you think he'd be engaging with our current world?
I think he would be a social critic, a political critic. He would definitely be a public intellectual. He witnessed the rise of Nazism when he was in Germany. I think he would have words to say about the dangers of that and the dangers of fascism, because he was, you know, he loved Germany, but the changes that he saw while he was there, you know, very concerning. And I think he died before he saw the worst of Hitler. So he would have a lot to say.
I agree. I think he would have the two big historical events that affected Wolf in his writing were the Great Depression, the stock market crash, and because that really hurt his family in Asheville, and then the rise of Nazism in Germany. And he wrote about those, not so much World War I, which many of the other modernists of his era, they were more focused on the impact of World War I. So I think Wolf would have, you know, whatever we're going through now, he would have written about it. Wolf, though, never lost his sense of optimism about America. Even though he was critiquing aspects of the economy and politicians and so on, he still had this underlying optimism and joy and celebration about the country, about the people and the places. So I think he would have held on to that in some way. He would still be a celebratory writer, not only a critic of the United States and the world.
Joe, I'm glad you mentioned his love for America. It reminds me of a passage that illustrates that, but it also gives us a sense of how exuberant and how sensitive he was. And I'm going to read a little bit of it. This is also from the reminiscences. So a friend of his named Kitty Hoagland, who was a writer herself, They were near a train station. And again, he loved trains, but to Joe's point, loved America. So this is what Kitty Hogan wrote. Tom looked and you'd think he was sniffing fire like a Dalmatian or something when he saw a freight car, because he got all excited and his eyes came to light. Everything came to light. And he threw his arms out and he looked at me and he said, "Kitty." You know, he always spoke with a kind of stutter. This is what she wrote when he got excited and wrapped in something. "Kitty, look, this is America. All over the country, there are little stations like this. With a tree, there's a siding with a factory for loading freight cars. Look at the rails. Here," he said, "come." And he made us kneel down and feel the vibrations on the tracks of a train that might be coming. Then he said, "Come along. I want to show you how you should write. See these walls? Feel them. You can't write except you feel them." I think that gives you a really good sense of where he's coming from. He just experienced life in a way that most of us don't. And then he tried to translate that into his fiction.
Well put. I love that passage as well. That's great. And speaking of passages, we're getting towards the end here. Do any of you have favorite passages of Wolfe's writing, or more remembrances, Mark, of Wolfe? I would love to just hear, if you have any ready to go, I'd love to hear some of his words and why you feel so strongly about them.
I have another one that fits with what Mark just read. If I could read it, it's a famous passage from Wolfe's final novel, posthumously published, You Can't Go Home Again. And it's in the last chapter called Credo. And it's very interesting commentary, I think, as we look at our world today. He writes this: "I believe that we are lost here in America, but I believe we shall be found. And this belief, which mounts now to the catharsis of knowledge and conviction, is, for me, and I think for all of us, not only our own hope, but America's everlasting living dream. I think the life which we have fashioned in America and which has fashioned us, the forms we made, the cells that grew, the honeycomb that was created, was self-destructive in its nature and must be destroyed. I think these forms are dying and must die, just as I know that America and the people in it are deathless, undiscovered, and immortal and must live. I think the true discovery of America is before us. I think the true fulfillment of our spirit, of our people, of our mighty and immortal land is yet to come. I think the true discovery of our own democracy is still before us. And I think that all these things are certain as the morning, as inevitable as noon." That's the sort of thing I think he would write even today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it resonates strongly. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely does. Paula, do you have a quote you'd like to read?
Yeah, one of my favorite is just the opening lines of Look Homeward, Angel. It captures more of a sense of the past and our connectedness, you know, to the past and those that preceded us. And it brings those connections forward. Just the first two paragraphs: "A destiny that leads the English to the Dutch is strange enough, but one that leads from Epsom into Pennsylvania and thence into the hills that shut in Altamont over the proud choral cry of the cock and the soft stone smile of an angel is touched by the dark miracle of chance, which makes new magic in a dusty world. Each of us is all the sums he has not counted. Subtract us into nakedness and night again, and you shall see begin in Crete 4,000 years ago, the love that ended yesterday in Texas." So he's connecting all of our histories, our past, into, you know, this dark miracle of chance, you know, that we're here. I mean, we are the sum of all that we have not counted, that we will never know. So I love that.
Mm-hmm. That's a great choice, Paula. That's one of my favorites too. And we've all mentioned The Death of Ben. We'll let people read that on their own, but I have to read. So I have a favorite one too. And it's the letter that he wrote to Max Perkins. I'm going to get choked up reading. I'm going to try not to. The letter that he wrote to Max Perkins when he knew that he was, or had a hunch, as he put it, that he was going to die. And I see Paula's nodding. She knows
what you're talking about. Yes.
She said he wrote this August 12th. So he dies about a month later in September. "Dear Max, I'm sneaking this against orders, but I've got a hunch, and I wanted to write these words to you. I've made a long voyage and been to a strange country, and I've seen the dark man very close. And I don't think I was too much afraid of him, but so much of mortality still clings to me. I wanted most desperately to live and still do, and I thought about you all 1,000 times and wanted to see you all again. And there was the impossible anguish and regret of all the work I had not done, of all the work I had to do. And I know now I'm just a grain of dust, and I feel as if a great window has been opened on life I did not know about before. And if I come through this, I hope to God I'm a better man, and in some strange way I can't explain, I know I'm a deeper and a wiser man. If I get on my feet again and get out of here, it will be months before I head back. But if I get on my feet, I'll come back. Whatever happens, I had this hunch and wanted to write you and tell you, no matter what happens or has happened, I shall always think of you and feel about you the way I did. It was that 4th of July day 3 years ago when you met me at the boat and we went out on the cafe on the river and had a drink and later went on top of the tall building and all the strangeness and the glory and the power of life and of the city was below. Yours always, Tom. It didn't get much better than that.
No, good stuff.
Which I think literally... Yeah. I think it would have been because he was out of his mind for the last month or so. So that's probably pretty good stuff to be on your deathbed in the situation he was in. But that's how this man could write.
And I love the mention, even as you said, the last thing he wrote before, you know, losing all brain power for the most part was about a memory. And that seems to be a through line through all of his work, yes. Is memory and writing to remember, but also perhaps to forget. I don't know.
It's a really important motif to pick up on. It certainly was, as you said, a through line in his work. And it's right here. I mean, it's that memory that's still in his mind. And back to what I'd said earlier, he felt compelled to put it on paper. I can only imagine how Perkins would have read that. I mean, they had had an editorial break at this point, but never any kind of break in terms of their relationship and their love for each other. And I just can't imagine what that would have been like for Perkins to have read that and remember. I'm sure he remembered that same moment 3 years ago and looking down on the city below.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As we start to wrap it up here, is there anything else about Wolfe or, you know, his legacy that we didn't touch on that anybody wanted to talk about for a little bit?
I would say Wolfe is a writer for many, many, many people. If you are seeking something, you will find it in Wolfe. You can go back to Wolfe time and time again, and you will find something new. He's never one to be tired of because there's so much to be discovered in his novels, his writings. I can't say that about many writers.
Yeah, well put. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Paula, Mark, Joe, thank you all for joining me today on this episode. I had a blast. And the best part is I can't wait to read more Thomas Wolfe.
Thank you.
Great to be
Thanks,
here.
Nate. Enjoyed it.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Wednesdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., only closed on Tuesdays for the summer. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.